To headlines, this is David Lichtenstein for an hour of learning, Hashkafa, and our yeshiva, Shalmaila, virtual yeshiva. This week we're going to be discussing the Shidduch crisis, possible solutions. We will have Rabbi Yisrael Freddy Friedman, who will be playing a solution proposed to the Gedolim, Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky, Rav Mendel Shafran, and in Eretz Yisrael to Rabbi Nissen Kaplan of the Mir. And then we will be discussing the halachas, what do you have to feel in Shidduchim and what not, with Rabbi Zev Smith and Rabbi Elchanan Adler, the Ram of Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan. I do want to remind everybody that we now have English and Israeli numbers. Our American number is 732-806-8700. In Eretz Yisrael, it's 02-372-0304. In England, it's 330-117-0250. And you can get us on Yeshiva World News, as well as our website, headlinestyra.com, and on our app, Headlines News. So, but before we start, I would like to say a little thought. I have a question. Many of us listening here are parents. Well, when does parenting, when does the love and support of parents end? How long? Do you know that there are opinions in halacha that say, if the parent says, Baruch Shep Tarani Mi'ein Shei Shal Zeh, he's finished. Chinuch is over. It's done. Ramesha will, if you go to the website, will bring the tshuva in the Dibris, and the Darash Maisha brings Makairis where he strongly disagrees, and he says, no, chedach, the support, the love of a parent does not end then. So when does parenting, when is it over? You know, Sukkis, three times we find it in Tanakh. It says, Vayovei, Vayakov Nasa Sukkaisa, after his encounter with Lavan, with Esav, he goes to Sukkis a second time. It says, Vayisu mi Ramsay Sukkaisa, after Mitzrayim. And by Geula Shniya, by Bia Shniya to Eretz Yisrael, Ezra builds a Sukkah. What's the commonality of these three Sukkis that we have in Tanakh? There's three seemingly random places where Sukkis is mentioned. Is there some commonality or is it random? Let me suggest something to you. What does a Sukkah represent? Well, it says, V'sukkah tia l'tzel yoimam. Sukkah will be a place of refuge, of shade. Michirev, the brutal Middle Eastern sun. First, people could die in it Friday, death. You ever out in the Israeli sun midday? So it's a place of refuge. Ulamascha ulamistar, and for shelter, mizerem umimatar, from storms and rain. So what is a sukkah? A place of shelter. Now we also know, so let's put it the two and two together. The Yaakov Nasa Sukkaisa. Yaakov leaves Lavan. He defeats Lavan. He defeats Esav, and he wants to shelter it. Klal Yisrael, the first Nesiyah after they leave Eretz Mitzrayim is Vayisu Miramsei Sukkaisa. B'yishniyah, they come back from the long, terrible, from the short, terrible gullus. Ezra builds a sukkah. It seems that after we've accumulated, we've reached a certain madrega, we leave after the geula, after the kapara, slicha, mechila of Yom Kippur, what do? We go to the sukkah to shelter it. They all have that in common. And you know why that is? The Gemara in Bracha says that every time by davening, it's supposed to be Yisaymich Geula L'Tfila, Yisaymich, the high of Geula, the Amun of a Geula to Tfila. He saved us once, he could save us again. He did for us, God, B'Bain Shalom, will do again. So the Gemara says, by Mairiv, you say Gal Yisrael, and then you say Hashkivenu. You're supposed to be Yisaymich Geula L'Tfila. So the Gemara says, no, Hashkivenu is a Geula Arichta. It's an extended Geula, a longer Geula. Why is that? Freisaleinu Sukkah Shlamecha. Right? And on Shabbos, what do you say? Pyrus Sukkah Shalem. You know what? A Geula without a Shmira, what's the use? Did you ever hear the story of Evan Ford? He won a lottery. It was like $5 million. 9 months later, he was broke. You see this all the time. Lottery winners who lose it all. A year, 24 months is the average. Most of them have gone through their money. Anything beautiful that you have, anything wonderful in this world, if there's no shmira to it, If there's no careful accounting, if there's no husbandry, no guardianship, it's lost. Without a shmirah, any mila you have will be lost. That's what it says. If you want to have a geula richta, you have to be pyrei sukkah shalem. Make sure to shelter it. Be a good guardian of your most valuable things. You have beautiful children. Be a guardian. There are all kinds of people willing to take advantage. Right? We need guardianship. So right after we had the high of defeating Lavan, Esav, Sukaisa, we had the high of thing of Gulas Mitzrayim, Sukaisa. The high of the Bia Shnia, Sukaisa. And it's interesting, by Bia Rishina they didn't do Sukaisa. So what do we say? Gula Rishina by Yehoshua was Kitchel Shaita Veloi Kitchel Asad Lavai. Because a Kedusha without a Shmira can't last. The second time Ezra came was Kitchel Shaita Asad Lavai. Why? Because there was a Sukkah there. Because we sheltered it. Now what does this mean? We have children, right? Do you know a child needs love? By bar mitzvah should be done? Wait, that's not a geula richta. Ramesha says, chinuch never ends. The love of a parent never, ever, ever ends. You want a geula richta? That hug of the sukkah, that embrace, that non-judgmentalism, kol yisrael, riyum leisha b'sukkah echas, that goes forever. If you want to have a geula richta, it never stops. And let me share with you a story. There was once an incredible Jew. He became one of the greatest Jewish leaders ever. But it says when he was born, he was ugly. And his father thought he was a mamza. He had one person who loved him and never stopped loving him, his mother. And his brothers despised him. His parents despised him. His father. What happens then because of the mother's love? He flourishes. He burgeons. You know, today they say, psychologists say, all we need is the love of one person for a person to blossom. One person. You know who this person was? The Medrash says David HaMelech, they thought was a mamza. And he says so in Tehillim, right? He says so in Tehillim. The Gemara says they thought he was an Adoim, he was not Roy Lavei Bekal. But the Gemara says, but in Tehillim, he says, they suspected me of being a mamza. Right? What do you say? Muzar Hayisi La'achai. The Nachri Lifnei'imi, that's Samach Tes, Muzar is Bilashin Mamza. Well, it's based on a Medrash, Yalkut HaMechiri, but what's the Medrash? It'll be on our website if you want to look. In other words, David HaMelech was despised. Evin Moasu Abayinim, he says on himself, Haisel Arash Pina. And do you know why this is? How did David flourish? He says, Ani Avdecha Ben Amasecha. There was one woman, my mother, who believed in me. My mother never, ever stopped believing in me. And that's how he became, from Evin Moasu Abanim, he became David Malka Meshicha. So if we want to have a Geula Richta, we want to have fabulous children, or it could be a friend, or it could be somebody we mentor, you know when the time to stop loving is? The answer is not never. Because if you want to be Saimach Geula Latvila, you need a Geula Richta. Or you could be the lottery winner who once had something wonderful and sadly lost it all. The time to stop loving is never. Let's go to our wonderful guests. We have on the phone with us, from Lakewood, New Jersey, Rabbi Yisrael Freddie Friedman, a Talmud of Edison, Brisk, and Lakewood, one of the famous Shadchanim in the world. And I say that with the greatest respect, because we know that it says, the Gemara says, what does Kaviyachol do? Now it says he's Isaac and Shidduchim. That's what the Rabbeinu Shalom does. So it's a truly, somebody says you have the same business line as the Rabbeinu Shalom. I think that's a very admirable thing. Welcome, Rabbi Friedman.
Thank you, and I appreciate it, even though this is short notice.
Rabbi Friedman, tell us there's a Shidduch crisis. In your opinion, why is there a Shidduch crisis? There are 50%, the Rabbeinu Shalom creates pretty much 50% boys, 50% girls. Why is there a Shidduch crisis?
I think scientifically it's actually like 50.5 boys and like 49.5 girls, actually. But ultimately, it's a math problem. You know, I mean, that's the way it's been explained to me over the last 7-8 years. And ultimately, I buy into it because it makes a lot of sense. Mathematically speaking, if everybody comes onto the market at 19 years old, so then you'd have, you know, one guy for every girl. But if all the boys are coming out to the market at 23 and the girls are coming at 19 and the population growth is whatever percent it is, which we know that it's, we're growing by leaps and bounds, whatever the number is, 5%, 7% a year. So ultimately for the 19-year-old girl, there's going to be less than the 23-year-old boy. So then, you know, you have to start closing the gap. And obviously there are boys that get married at 21 and there are girls that get married at 21, but primarily at 19 is when the girls are pushing and pressing to get married with a sense of urgency. And at 23 is when the boys are pressing, and before and after those times, that's already, you know, considered not in the allotted time. So if everyone's trajectory is 23 and 19, you're going to have people that fall between the gap, mathematically speaking. I'm sure you could appreciate that.
So Rabbi Friedman, if we extend that math, and you take, let's say, a 30-year-old boy who technically has 11 years of girls he could go out with, whereas a 30-year-old girl only has 30 and up. So at that point in time, it would seem that the girl has just a really tiny pool of boys, where the boy has a huge pool. Is that correct? So as people get older, this problem gets very exacerbated. Is that fair to say?
That's very fair to say. And also, because of supply and demand, which is what dictates everything, every market, or I wouldn't call this a market, but I would call this, a problem. Supply and demand is what the primary problem is here, because now the boys are simply able to dictate whatever they want, however much money, support, and this is a problem which is very, very confined to the American. I say American because in Israel there is no such problem, because, I mean, even though it's a slight problem, it's definitely not as catastrophic as we have over here in America. And that's because boys are dating at 21 and girls there don't start dating till 21. So they don't have this age gap crisis. And that's why they don't have a shidduch crisis. Chassidim don't have this problem because Chassidim start dating all at the same age. In fact, someone told me in Ger, because the boys are starting to date younger than the girls, they have the opposite problem, you know, which makes sense. So it's a math problem.
So, Rabbi Friedman, no. I have a question for you. You're a Talmud Chacham, a Talmud of three great yeshivas.
Okay.
But here's to me a thing. If somebody's a shadchan and there's a 30-year-old boy and he says, look, I want to go out with this 21-year-old girl. Now, in effect, there is some other 29 or 30 or 31-year-old girl who he is being ma'agein by doing that, because he's saying, oh, I am mathematically excluding those of my peers who I should have been marrying, right? Do you think, and there are, my wife coaches all the singles in dating, and she says it's just terrific, especially by the girls. You know, when they reach the ages of 34, 35, there's a substantial chance that they will never get married. Like, I don't know, it could be a 40 or 50% chance. I don't know the numbers, but it's high. Do you feel it that it's morally, you know, when I say morally, that's an English word, but I would say mus from mitam musa hashkafa, to read a 30-year-old boy, a 20-year-old girl? I mean, somebody, I would turn around to the boy and I say, I can't do that. You're turning me into a reitzeach, into a ma'agein. Do you find that there's a moral issue with doing that?
I mean, even if I found that it was a moral issue, there'd be absolutely nothing for me to do about it. You know, I mean,
I'm not Chas V'Shalom attacking you for. This is just asking you in an intellectual way. Like, you turn to the boy and you say, "Hey, you should be marrying somebody your age. We're a community. We're supposed to be. You know, there's a concept of arvus where one. Why would you want to be ma'agin, a 29-year-old girl, because you want a girl who's 10 years younger than yourself? It's just not right.
I mean, in theory, you're 100% right. I mean, the moral aspect to it is wrong. But who are you, like, are you going to be mechanachis to every shatchan broker, mentor in the world? And, you know, I mean, I guess so. You could put out that mission statement, but ultimately, Shachanim are just brokers. They're bringing what the customer wants. If a 30-year-old guy comes in and says, I only want a 20-year-old girl, I'll probably throw him out of the room, but he'll go to someone else and somebody will give him a 20-year-old girl or a 21-year-old girl who read it to him. And,
but Rebbe Yisrael, let me tell you about a discussion we had. There's, you know, the emir of Qatar, different ways to pronounce it, who's an avowed anti-Semite. I mean, he backs Al Jazeera, Hamas, etc., came to this country, and he got a Frumma advertiser, a guy who went to a Frumma yeshiva to work, gave him a big budget to run a PR campaign to cleanse him. And when this guy was asked, how could you represent an anti-Semite? He said, well, if they wouldn't come to me, they would come to somebody else. So why shouldn't I make the money? And I find that an issue. It's like somebody selling drugs, and he says, look, if they're not going to get the opioids from me, they'll get it from somebody else. So I'm not saying that I could stop the guy from getting his opioids, but I could say, knowing the suicide rate in our community, I would not advocate selling opioids, even if he can get it to somebody else. Why should I be the shliach for a tzicha? And I just wonder, and you're saying that as a shadchan, you would throw the guy out, but I just want to know that at least intellectually.
Anyway, Shadchanim, in a 30-year-old guy, you know, girl, a 30-year-old and 31-year-old, you know, girls themselves and parents of girls reach out to me all the time about Shadchanim. The problem is that any boy or guy, whatever, is 30 years old, not going through a Shadchan anymore. You know, he's looking for it himself. He's on Sayyot Sinai. He's on J-Day, Frumster, yeah. J-Swipe, you know.
But it could be a 26-year-old boy who wants to go out with a 19-year-old girl. And I think the appropriate response is go out with girls who are more age-appropriate because we are a community. We are one living goof of Klal Yisrael. And you are hurting somebody else by doing this. You are you are depriving somebody of a shidduch. You are being ma'akin
somebody.
Well, I mean,
what do you tell the guy who's 25 years old who just started dating, and he's going out with girls who are 23, 24, that are very experienced, probably more intelligent than him, have more life experience than he has, and each and every one of them is saying no to him, because, like, they're just totally not compatible, doesn't have the maturity. So then what do you tell him? He shouldn't get married? He shouldn't?
No.
Or should he go out with someone a little younger who's a little bit more compatible, you know?
There are many 23-year-olds who are in the same situation, who haven't really gone out. They had an older sister. They weren't this.
No,
they weren't that.
The only true way of solving this crisis is having boys get younger. We've gone through this in every article, every newspaper, editorial, advertorial, Project Nasi. People threw money at it. Mishpacha magazine article that was written by Shlomo Refnitz a couple years ago. Addressed it, you know, it with an in-depth solution, and still we've chosen to ignore. So ultimately, it's a massive, massive problem, and once again, we know exactly what the problem is, and we've identified it, because these problems are not in the Hasidic community, and these problems are not in the Israeli community. So, therefore, we can deduce very simply that this is a problem exclusively in the American yeshivish, quote, you know, yeshivish is a broad terminology, because it can go from anywhere, you know, it can go from Lakewood to Five Towns. But when I say yeshivish, I mean, you know, I don't necessarily mean, you know, greasy yeshivish. I mean, in the yeshiva community, the litvish yeshiva community, in the Beis Yaakov system, in the system where boys are going to Eretz Yisrael, Bris.
Well, they could make, or alternatively, they could have the girls start going out later.
Right, but who's going to be the guinea pig that's going to put their daughter, push their daughter back 2 years from dating when every one of her friends are, you know, jumping ship? I mean, that would be a great approach if that would be implementable. But ultimately, I think it's just much easier to have the boys go out earlier. You know, let the boys start dating at 20, 21. And it's happening. It's happening slowly. But it's not happening quick enough. That's the problem. But that is the solution. That's the only solution. The only solution is closing the age gap. And it takes away so many different problems that come along with Shidduchim, because there are so many new problems that have been created that are all ancillaries to this main problem, you know, the support crisis. In the Hasidic community, there is no support crisis where girls have to start giving more money, because everything is, it's an even playing field. Nobody has more or less demand. Today, in the yeshiva community, because the boy feels like, and the boy's parents feel like they're in the driver's seat, they have demands. And because they have demands, so a lot of people tell me, listen, you know, I would like a partner and support, you know. And then their daughter comes on the market, and the boy says, the boy's parents say, listen, I just had two daughters that came off the market, and I had to give this and this and this amount of money, and the boy's side gave nothing, so I'm not interested in paying for my son right now. So suddenly there's a new, you understand what I'm saying? Now
and how much,
says, you know,
how much, and how much does that cost? I mean, I don't have any kids in this. How much, when you talk about it,
it's a very broad question, you know, especially when the girl's 19 without any college and she wants to go to Israel, and, you know, there's so many different variables. Does
but
she have a
like,
job? Is she able to get...
So give me, like, the you know, the high and the low. Like, give me some ideas.
It depends on people's standard of living. It depends on so many different factors, you know. There are yeshivish people that could live on, you know, $3,000 a month all in with the wife's job. I don't know exactly how they're doing it, but they figure it out, you know. And there are people that are living on $10,000 a month. You know, it depends on, you know, the girl grew up spoiled or, by you know, the boy, and they have a lot of different demands and needs and tzuchim, you know. The sky is the limit.
And usually you're saying the girls end up paying for it.
I'm saying that the demand is always on the girls. You know, that's what ends up eventually happening a lot of times is, you know, there are fights about it, but there's this underlying sort of understanding by most people going into shidduchim that it's the brunt of the responsibility is the girls. Like, it doesn't even make sense. There's no in the world this doesn't exist. You understand?
So, well, can I ask you? So let me ask you, Rabbi Friedman. Let me ask you a question. There was an Aguda convention many years ago, and they had a round table. It was called Ask the Rosh Yeshiva. So a lady got up at the end, and she said she has a question for Rabbi Svei. I heard the story from Rabbi Horowitz. Rabbi Yaakov Horowitz was there. I haven't been by an Aguda convention in decades. And he said that the woman said, she said, you know, my husband learned by the Rosh Yeshiva. And after we had, you know, been learning for and his friend learned by the Rosh Yeshiva. And he said that after a number of years, my husband came to Rosh Yeshiva. He says, you know, I can't make ends meet. What should I do? I could either go to work or I could get a job as a sixth grade Rebbe someplace. So Rabbi Svei said, you should bly by the learning. So he said, she got a job. His friend went to Rosh Yeshiva. He said, also, get a job. He didn't listen and he went to work. And he became very successful. He says, now me and this friend have daughters in Shidduchim. And they were both read a boy in Philadelphia, and they came to the Rosh Yeshiva, and they said, which the boy asked? He said, which girl should I go out with? So the Rosh Yeshiva said, you should go out with the one who could support you, which is the working one. So in effect, you have B'nai Torah who are being penalized because they don't have money. Balabatim, on the other hand, who went out to work, have first choice. Do you see that as a moral issue?
Again, even if I saw it as a moral issue, what would that, you know?
I'm just asking for an intellectual vacuum. Do you see that? I'm not asking you as a shadchan what to do about it. I'm just asking you, as somebody who handles in this parsha, is this something that you've come across and struggle with? Like, why should this person, because, you know, they didn't put their life to Torah, why should they get second pick over somebody who... Do you come across this issue, and like, how would you deal with it on an intellectual level?
The short answer is, on an intellectual level, first of all, being a balabas is challenging in shidduchim as well, especially if you're looking for, you know, the top boy. A lot of times, the top tyradika great boy really wants a shver. You know, I don't know the story with Rebel Yisrael. I've heard that story 100 times, but ultimately, like, the top guys that I deal with are looking for shvers that are chashiv, that are not even Rosh Yeshivas, but like sitting and learning, that they can, so many boys tell me, I want someone who I can handle with my shver. So that puts the balabas at the disadvantage also, you know? Again,
that's a beautiful thing to hear. I mean, kol masiyah bitay la maritz, kiloy siyah l'stay, you know, and it says, you know, lo'ilam yasiyah des bitay l'talmud chacham. Labas Talmud Chacham.
Right. So
you're saying that that is a criteria by a lot of the Chashuva boys.
A lot of the Chashuva boys. And now you could say suddenly the father who went to work schwitzing to support yeshivas and do whatever he had to do, suddenly he's a, and his daughter who's a top girl who went to BJJ and wants a top boy is suddenly at a disadvantage to a girl whose father sat and learned all day versus the person who went and worked to support the guy, you know? There's so many different criterias in Shidduchim and so many different, there are so many different injustices in the world. We're not going to, I'm not going to get through all of them, you know, but of course, you know, if you're talking about a select few Balbatim that, you know, that have made a tremendous amount of money and have supported yeshivas and people aren't just necessarily looking for money in Shidduchim. People are also looking for Tyredic and, you know, just because a guy made money, you know, if he's a cheap guy or he's a guy who's, you know, who's not a Balstucka, which, I mean, which is essentially the same thing, but he's also penalized in Shidduchim, you know? So it doesn't just go make money, buy the best guy. It doesn't work that way. And also, it doesn't necessarily work that, you know, this story with Rebellious Faith is definitely, it's not an anomaly. I understand exactly the concept of what they're referring to. Of course, somebody who can support has an advantage, but there are other ways to come up with advantages for your daughter just because you don't have money, you know? A girl who's a top girl and who's a beautiful girl and who's behind and who did everything right, you know, she's going to have a very, very fair shot of getting a top guy also, you know? You don't see that the top guys are only going for money. In fact, most of the top guys I know are not going for money. They're going for Tyredic and Chashuv and, you know, whatever their criteria is. So, again, who knows what top and what's not top. You understand what I'm saying, right?
We're going to talk a little bit about Shidduchim here. And, you know, it's really a tragedy. All the singles, it's just a silent tragedy. It's almost a silent holocaust for them. I heard from, you know, the Chevra Kadisha, they're doing more and more taharis about single women who never got married. You know, there's just not enough men. Why they leave the fold. Women are more, they stay religious. Guys leave the fold, statistics say. Many of them, I don't know, break down. Something happens. Men over 30, something weird happens. And there's, so should we be doing more to try to catch kids, the boys when they're 25, the girls when they're 22, to try to push them to get married younger? And we should maybe loosen some of our tradition of separatism, of keeping them so separate. Here's an interesting thing. You know, the Gemara says at the end of Perek Aleph of Tainus that in the olden days, they used to go out, the girls on Rosh, and the boys, on Yom Kippur, the day of Yom Kippur itself. Could you imagine this? After Musaf. And on Tu B'Av. And they would mingle together, and the girls would say, marry me because I'm beautiful, or because I'm rich, or because I'm a yuchas. Today we don't have that custom anymore. So the Kolbe was a Rishon, maybe the beginning of the Achrayinim, he says that it's in Simon Samach Beis, he says, there are many girls whose fathers or circumstances don't allow them to get married. And he says, maybe they would sit, at Shetal ben Rosham. Their hair would turn white, imloy al yedei haminig hazeh, were it not for the fact that they would have this minig, that the girls and boys would meet on Tu B'Av and Yom Kippur. He said there would be boys and girls whose, he said particularly girls, he says, here's his lashon, v'ulai hayu yoshvosh ad shetal ben roshan, imloy al yedei haminig hazeh, the kol bayin simin samach bay. So the question is, should we be doing more after the boys are a little older, the girls a little, to allow them to mingle? You know, there's a woman, a wonderful woman in Muncie, her name is Judy Steinberger, where she had an idea. She said, after the chasanis, after the chuppah, there's usually an hour break waiting for pictures. He says, wouldn't it be so fabulous if people would take a room, and it cost a few $100s, a chasan and kala would be a gift to all the singles, where boys over 25 and girls over 22, there would be a room. Go mingle there. You're already all dressed up. Put a few shadchanim in the room and let them talk to each other. And they say, who knows, the Yetzer Hara is rampant. Well, that's good the Yetzer Hara is rampant because that's why we get married. If it weren't for Yetzer Hara, nobody would get married, right? So let's hear what our Gedolim have to say about this. And we'll start again with Hagoyin Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky.
We have to try whatever we can do. We should not mingle too much. It's a a sakana. Mingling is sakana.
What would be if it was done with shatchanim or people there to oversee it?
Wonderful. Should be done that way.
Okay.
Now let's hear what Rav Shafran, he's from Bnei Brak, what he says. It's very interesting. He says, do it, but don't ask for Rabbanim, for Askama. Don't ask them to put their stamp on everything. Should if something goes wrong, you have somebody to hang. Try it. And then he says, if you try it, maybe you'll be successful. Really, such practical advice.
He's right that things could be different. And when you change things like this, you have to take into account all the hashgachot. How do you say hashgachot in English? The outcomes of this in different aspects. Yes, things like this probably will change. If it becomes more a bigger problem, Memeret by itself will change. Telling the bottom to change things you say it from one end to the other, change things very radically, has very much hashgachot, has very much different
impact.
Kinds of outcomes.
Yeah, outcomes. Yeah.
Outcomes. And you have to take that in cheshbon when you do it. I'm asking if it could help some older bochum for shiduchim. I'm asking if it could do different things. Also, it could make change when you start doing things. It has a lot of hashgachot and different kind of things, and you have to be mitmoded with different problems. And there's always problems you have to be mitmoded with. And solving a problem with just mekomi in one thing is not so posh. You have to.
So I'll tell you, there was an interesting.
Anyway, it's more probable to let things change by themselves. Such things.
There was there's a lady in Muncie. She came up with an idea. She said, you know, a lot of times people try to make get-togethers where boys and girls with shatchanim, they come together in the middle of the week. She said, people in the middle of the week, they're working. You tell a boy, go get dressed for a chasana. The girl, go get put on make. It's very hard. She said, after the chuppah in America, there's like an hour break between the chuppah and when the chasana comes in because the families go for pictures. I don't think they have that in Eretz Yisrael. So this lady said, why don't they take a room by every chasana where they have three or four shatchanim, and a boy who's over 25, a girl who's over 22 or 23, they come together, the shatchanim try to. He says, everybody's dressed fancy already. It would be under the hashgacha of, it won't be Yevul Dezach, there'll be people there. And this way, maybe we could stop, Rachmana Litzlan, Hamatzel Nefesh Eches Meisrael. Imagine how many nefeshes you could be matzel. What would the Rav say to an idea like that?
I would say it's a good idea. But let someone do it without an official hechsher of this and this rov or this and this godel. Somebody should do it by themselves. They should do it. And automatically there'll be some snagdim and some ba'ad and some neged. And these things are mitpateach.
They develop.
They develop by themselves, on a certain kivun. And someone should do it. But if he wants a hechsher and merosh, right away, this and this road said that we should make such a room. That's not the right way to do it. He should do it by himself, try it in small, in a certain way. And when things are matzriach, so you can't fight with atzkachot. And if it's not matzriach, so then you go down from it.
Let's hear the opinion of Hagoyin Rav Herschel Schechter, who says he would absolutely do it.
We are loosening the strings. What do you mean? We are trying to have people meet each other. It's a good idea. You should try to have boys and girls meet.
Now let's hear what Rav Nissen Kaplan has to say. Okay.
I'll tell you. It's a hard question. I know people have today a lot of kind of meetings. Now, I slipped out of my head. I know two or three domain of mine that run such organizations that they have over 10 or 20 boys and girls older, and they put on these tables, and you move from one table to the other table. I'm sure you're familiar with that.
Yeah.
If they need, I can get you the information. I think that is much better from the idea of this rough. And I want to explain. He's written in the old days. Things were written down like that. It's brought down, but it's a slogan, it's a selekromim, umecholes, soinecho, loilezeh, loilezeh, loilezeh.
I named Kippa.
In our yeah. But in our generation, the Zohar is very strong as well.
Have a Rav there, have a Shatz in there. We're not talking about to do it in a Kerem. We're talking about it by a Chazan.
What I mean to say, when you do it in a set house with a set plan, I think it's much more calm and it's much more normal. But it's in a chuppah, everyone could walk in. A person that is not really planning to look now for a shidduch, why not to have a good time? You know, we had people that are dishonest also in our generation. When it's a wedding and everyone is dressed nicely and everyone is there and everyone is put together, you know, we don't know what could be in the end of the night in the wedding. Yeah? And these boys and girls are going to stay there for the whole evening. I think it's much better in the way that these people are doing it, that sounds like a kind of solution to help the older people.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was certainly a very interesting exchange.
We're going to go back now to Rabbi Yisrael Freddy Friedman and the discussion of Lashon Hara and what should and shouldn't be revealed. Rabbi Friedman, what do you feel about like Lashon Hara? You know, people are worried, it's Lashon Hara. You know, my son was going out and she was read a girl and whoever we called, my wife said she just felt it was, so she called her, yeah, she was very good, and then a friend of hers said, look, find out why she missed 4 months in school, you know, her last year in school. So my wife found out, that the girl was anorexic, which is, it's fine, but it's dealable. It says, but people felt, no, it's Lashon Hara to disclose that. What is your, tell us the Das Torah that you've accepted, I shouldn't say Das Torah because that's political, but the psakim that you've received and that you use and that you would ask somebody, what's Lashon Hara and what's not?
It's interesting. In 11 years of being a shatan, I've never, ever met a girl that had a documented case of anorexia, because anytime she's totally anorexic, they always have a teric, you know? No, it was a high school, it was a kufa, anxiety. She loves food, you know, even, you know, so there's always like that's almost the worst label to have in Shidduchim is anorexia. And that's why people seemingly to me, it looks like people are trying to hide it because I don't blame them because, you know, you're in a very, very tricky position when it comes to these types of disclosures, because it could mean it like a death sentence in Shidduchim. If a girl gets labeled as someone who has an eating disorder, and again, a lot of times people don't know the facts. But you know, girl, she left school for 4 months. Maybe she was anorexic. Maybe she wasn't. Maybe she was dealing with a different issue. A lot of times people speculate, and it's hard to be the one that takes the cry. And again, of course, you know, I'm not a rav. I never claimed to be a rav. I don't know Hilchos Lashon Hara at all, so I can't tell you the halachic ramifications of it. It's not my area of expertise. But I could tell you that, you know, you have to think before you talk also. And also, you have to be able to have – listen, let's put it this way. If your sister was in Shidduchim, okay, and your friend you thought had a mental illness, would you telling your sister, would that be Lashon Hara? No, right? That's someone you care for, and that's your own speculative thing, and you know you could trust them and that it's not going to go further. And you say, listen, this guy rubs me the wrong way. Don't go out with him. Is that Lashon Hara? I mean, you know, so you always have to find someone in Shidduchim that's closer to you than it is to them to find out the real bottom line story, you know? It doesn't have to necessarily be, obviously, a sibling.
But Rabbi Fried, my question is that we're dealing with two counter things. We have on one hand Lashon Hara. On the other hand, there's a concept of Loisame Del Dam Riecha. Like, you know, Rav Oldenburg writes in a psak, he was asked by somebody, you know.
But again, who really knows the facts when it comes to...
The person who does I'm talking if you do know the facts, or you have, you have reasonable weight, you know, you have rias, whatever. I mean, somebody's anorexic, it's sort of visible to the eye, something that's nicker lying, right, for the most part. So my point is, how do you, and you have to deal with this on a daily basis, how do you separate the Isser of Leisame Del Dam Riecha with the Isser of Lashon Hara, the two countervailing Is this or is this something that you say, look, it's not my area of expertise, which I accept too?
It's for sure not my area of expertise, but I'm just thinking as a logical person, like Simon Adam Riecha seems to be a much bigger issue than Lashon Hara, right?
Right,
so,
I would agree with that.
Just from a logistical perspective, obviously, if you're putting someone in a position where they're going to ruin their lives with their whole – first of all, it's probably not Lashon Hara. Again, I don't know the hell of Lashon Hara, but if you're going to ruin somebody's life by not – by
No,
by,
it's certainly it would certainly be Latayelis, yes.
Right. Okay, so then that's not a question.
So would you say that in your experience, do people disclose what they should disclose? And I'm not talking about the individuals. I'm talking about when asked for information, do you find that Lashon Hara trumps Lysamed Aldam Riecha for the most part?
Again, I think people are honest with their friends. You know, there's loyalty, you know. Lashon Hara is, you know, it's obviously a major issue. But when it comes to Shaduchim, if you have a real friend, you'll get down to the bottom of it, you know, and they'll tell you the Lashon Hara, if it's even considered Lashon Hara, which
it's
I don't think it is.
It's not Lashon Hara.
Mm-hmm. Right. So usually you'll find, in a shidduch, you'll find someone that likes you better than, you know, that's closer to you than to them, that will give you the information that you need. So
right.
That's how people do research. You know, when you look at someone's references, they're just point of references. You know, that's where you find out where, you know, who their friends are, so you can get to their friends' friends and find out the truth, you know? So I look at all these resumes. It's just fluff, you know? You got to find out from your references, not from their references. But that's just, you know, regular, that's the logical perspective. I think that's just the, you know, again, I'm not a Rav and I'm not a, you know, any halachic authority whatsoever to make any of these decisions, but, you know, I think that's just, you know,
so Rabbi Friedman,
basic logic.
Rabbi Yisrael Freddy Friedman, thank you for your time. It was wonderful, enlightening speaking to you.
Thank you. We'll be in touch.
Also, have a good day. Bye-bye.
Okay.
We have on the phone Rabbi Elchanan Adler, Ram in Shivas Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan.
When asked by strangers if everyone in a particular family is healthy or are there learning disabilities, what is and isn't necessary to be disclosed?
Okay, so there's a lot of variables, obviously, in this issue. The Chofetz Chaim deals with issues of Shidduchim in the Sefer, and one of the first things he says is that you can extrapolate from one situation to another. So we're going to speak about guidelines, but the truth is, you know, every situation is unique. You have to know who's asking the question, and based on that, whether it's appropriate to answer and how to answer. I guess it's important to step back for a second and just try to identify some of the issues that we're dealing with in general, in terms of the Makoros. And this, some of these issues are relevant for a Shadchan, some are issues that are relevant for a third party, and some of the issues are relevant for the parties themselves. First of all, we're talking about, obviously, Lashon Hara and Rechilos. If we're talking about a third party, whenever you speak negatively about somebody else, then potentially we're talking about, you know, issues of Lashon Hara. On the other hand, if there's a situation where somebody's welfare is threatened, then you have a mitzvah to divulge and to disclose. There are issues of eitzah she'en hogenes, which means, of course, that if you're pushing something on somebody which is clearly not in their best interest, then you're talking about an issa d'oraisa of lifnei iver. And that's obviously especially relevant for a shadchan who has a vested interest in obviously trying to get a shidduch to work. But if it's clearly not in the interest of the person, then, you know, obviously you have a problem there. You have issues between the people, and that has to do with genevas das in terms of misrepresenting yourself. And just as with a sale and a commodity, you can't misrepresent what you're selling. So in that sense also, you can discuss shidduchim from that perspective. Going back to the question that you raised, so just remind me again, the question is?
There are health issues in the family. There are not necessarily the meduberes or the boy himself, but the family has a number of other members in the family, either with learning disabilities, other diseases, and they ask the shadchan, are there health issues in the family? Or they ask a stranger, rather. They call up a reference. Should it or shouldn't it be disclosed?
Okay, so if you're asked a question point blank, you can't lie. You have to either give the full answer, the full truth, or you can be somewhat evasive. And that doesn't mean that you have to necessarily say exactly what the issues are. If the issues obviously are very serious, then you have to be more clear about the fact that there could be potential concerns. If the issues are not necessarily serious, and so what kind of issues are we talking about? If there are issues that people, people deal with it, and people take medication, and people are basically functioning, then I don't know that you have to necessarily say anything.
What would be the situation, I was asked this by Mrs. Schiffenbauer, if the boy or the girl had cancer as a child, but it's in remission, and it's been in remission for 5 years, which at which point physicians would consider it to be cured, would it have to be disclosed?
So Rav Sternbach has a tshuva about this. Rav Sternbach says that he talks about possibly distinguishing between the boy and the girl. He's talking not just about the issue you're talking about, but also emotional issues and mental health issues. He says perhaps with a girl where should she become pregnant, it could be more likely to create a recurrence. There might be more of a reason for the young woman to say something about it. But then again, if the doctors can vouch for the fact that the odds are not very likely that it will have a recurrence, he doesn't feel that either one should have to reveal something like this.
So, Rabbi Adler, recently a well-known case in New York where a boy had gotten married and hadn't disclosed a very serious illness, not life-threatening, but a serious illness, and had caused a very fractious divorce. Had created a community issue, people taking sides, et cetera. According to the Stipler, are you saying that what the boy did would be okay because in Shidduchim, because of Pru Revu, there's no need to, you can overlook Aina and Gnev Zas?
Stipler seems to be saying that if the condition would have been such that after the fact they would be prepared to stay married, then it would not go under. In other words, the study would agree that if the problem was such that it would be a deal breaker, not just in advance, but post facto, everybody would want out, such a thing would be required to be revealed, and it would clearly be us to go forward without revealing it. He's talking about a case where if they'd know in advance, they would not want to continue with the shidduch, but if they'd be married already, they'd be willing to stay married.
And how do you deal with Aina?
So he makes the point that on two levels. Number one, because the nature of shidduchim is different than buying just whatever it is, because of the fact that it's not someone, you would not view a marriage in the same way you'd view buying something. Buying something, you get back your money and you would start again. You get the next item. Here, it's a very different situation. The complexities of human relationships are such that you want to be married, and if this is the one you're married to, then you don't want to start looking again. Who knows if you'll find somebody else?
I understand, but that's post.
People are not
post
a package. People are a package deal. In other words, you basically come to terms with whatever you have.
Let me ask you another question. This is by a Rebbe last week as well. A boy was molested as a child. Would somebody have to disclose that?
The Chavetz Chaim in Klal Tesh and in Rechilos, where he talks about things that you have to reveal. It's interesting. He mentions illnesses that are not known to the other party. He talks about apikorsis, heresy, and he also talks about bayis shel pritzus. Bayis shel pritzus means where you have things going on in the house where clearly are taboos which are being violated, and gilui arayos and so on, and issues of abuse. That, the Chavetz Chaim says, needs to be revealed. But we have to realize a couple of things. How do you reveal it? Who do you reveal it to? The devil is always in the details. You can stop the shidduch without saying specific things about the person, just knowing, making sure the shidduch doesn't go through. Don't necessarily, and the person trusts you, you don't have to say exactly what it is, because the person obviously is scarred for life in any case. But if they're trying to at least get over it and go through whatever therapy it will take to be able to get their life back together, if you're going to reveal this, there's literally no hope for them. So, you know, you have to do all you could right now to not allow such a shidduch to go forward. And I would say even in the case of a sibling, because once you have a situation of this in the house, you never know, you know, who's been affected. But again, you have to be discreet. You also have to know who you're speaking to. In other words, if the person you're speaking to is someone who's going to reveal it to the whole world, then again, you're getting into a lot of potential other problems, which again, you have to be able to balance with, you know, obviously the immediate concern as well. To the extent that the individual will say it, you don't have to be the one to say it. If you're clear that gets to a certain point in the shidduch, or, you know, maybe it should be, you know, very early on, but maybe, you know, at some point it has to be revealed. So you have to be the one to reveal it. As long as it's something that can be communicated in the proper way, you know, that could be sufficient.
We're talking to Rabbi Elchanan Adler of Rabbi Shivas Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan, and we're discussing shidduchim, what to reveal and what not to reveal. Here's a question that came in from Chaim from Flatbush. He says, if the parents fight and there are serious shalom bayis issues at home, is that something that should be disclosed by somebody who's called for information?
It's not a simple matter. Obviously, it's something which can obviously have taken a toll on the child. To the extent that you're aware of the details and how much of a toll it took, obviously, you know, you may be in a position to say it. But again, does it have to be you? It's important that if trust is being built between the couple and they're going to get married, then these things should be shared. It doesn't automatically mean that the child is scarred for life. It could be that if they had the right therapy and they're able to get stronger from the situation so they can have a very productive and wholesome life. You have to know, you know, the details in terms of the nature of how it's affected the child, and based on that, how it will affect the shidduch itself and the life together with the spouse.
Rabbi Elchanan, let me ask you another question. What would you say if you took that position a one step further? I had somebody ask me this question this week too. The parents were actively looking to get divorced. Is that something you would say?
I think it has to be revealed. The question is, does it need to be revealed before they even go out for the first date? You know, we'll talk about the timing. You know, there's a lot to be said about when.
Halachically, clearly it doesn't. The question is, when you're called, you don't know if you're going to be called back after 3 or 4 or 5 dates. So this may be the only time you're called.
Right. If the question is very specific, and they'll ask me about the shalom bayis for the parents, and I know that very fact that you just mentioned, I can see, I don't want to tell you 100%, but I can be inclined, if I felt that the information would be treated properly and not spread, and I felt that I can trust the people who I was speaking to not to spread it, I could consider sharing that, but not exactly in the way that you're saying it. Not to say that they're about to get divorced, and I know they are, but, you know, more in the sense that, you know, it may be some issues of shalom bayis, especially if that's how they're asking the question, so I could say it. But again, to a stranger, I don't know. I have to feel like I know if I have a relationship with, I have Baruch Hashem, Talmidim, whose parents I have a relationship with. So if I know them and I have a relationship with them, then I'm more likely to say something which I know that they will not share with others. If I'm talking to parents who I don't know or a stranger, I don't know that I could share that information either.
Okay, let's take a phone call. We have Yehoshua from Brooklyn on line one. Yehoshua, do you have a question for Rabbi Adler?
I'm not sure if it's a question or more of an important guideline that was shared with me a while back. And my wife and I are involved in helping young people with shidduchim as much as we can. I feel all young couples are the best physician team out there to try to help the shidduch crisis. But just to focus on one principle, talking about Ahavas Yisrael and compassion and kindness for all parties involved, I wish to just emphasize that nobody benefits and there is no kindness in the long run by trying to push through a shidduch on any type of pretenses that will be revealed to be misrepresenting. In other words, ultimately the resentment and the feeling of being duped will haunt the relationship, and it cannot be kind for either party to be stuck in that type of relationship. For the one doing the duping or for the one feeling duped, if it's meant to be, this is a guideline from the Lubavitcher Rebbe, if it's meant to be, then the information that seems to be adverse or unappealing will not faze the party, the real Bashert. And by the way, the story you just demonstrated is a perfect example. The Bachar that had that history in his background, the panic attacks, somehow that family was comfortable going ahead with a shidduch, even with this fact revealed before the wedding, very close to the wedding.
Let me just say, add a little punctuation point to what you're saying. You know, we know many people are nizer in the Sefer Hasidim, almost more than the Shulchan Aruch in certain ways. Like if it's in the Sefer Hasidim, they won't do it. The Shulchan Aruch takes second class. So here's the Sefer Hasidim in Tavkuf of Zion says that lo yachasa adam mum bnei beso. A person should not conceal a mum. And he says, if yesh maisim roem lahem, sh'ilu hayudim lahayu mischatnim bhem, farsim. He says, a person has to reveal anything that if the other side knew about it, it would be an issue with them in the marriage. So what you're saying from the Lubavitcher Rebbe is not only good practical advice, but so it's interesting that there are many people who won't give the same name, and when a window is covered, will make sure to leave a hole. But yet when it comes to revealing minor things, like things that would upturn a marriage upside down, don't seem to take this admonition to heart. So thank you very much. You go ahead, Rabbi Adler. What do you
have to say? I echo it. I happen to agree, and I think it's mentioned by Shlomo Zalman as well. He says, you know, the kind of resentment that lingers after the fact that something, like we mentioned before, the case where there was a condition that was healed, if you have cancer, Rahman al-Litzlan, and right now the doctors say there's no possibility of remission, but not to reveal it is also, you know, it creates a sense of starting the marriage with a, you know, not being straightforward, and it creates resentment afterwards. So I agree with you.
Now, what would you say, Rabbi Yadla? A girl had an affair, and she's done tshuva since then, and now she, you know, is a totally wonderful, this is dealt with in the Paiskim.
But Moshe has a tshuva about this, Moshe Feinstein, yeah.
And it's interesting, the Marsham has a tshuva about this too, and the Marsham says, he was asked, it happened to be an orphan. He says, when an orphan, a mail order bride who had an affair, and actually, had a child that I imagine was given up for adoption, and the boy doesn't know about it, and does she have to reveal? And the Marsham says she does not have to reveal the fact that she had an affair, which is not as Ramesha says, and in fact, he goes into a lengthy way how they should write the ksuba and read the ksuba at the wedding so that it's not problematic. What are your thoughts about this, Rabbi Adler?
I'm very much inclined to say like Ramosha. I think that it has to be revealed. Again, you know, Baruch Hashem, she's done tshuva, but as Ramosha puts it in the tshuva, she should tell him before they get engaged that I this was where I was then, and I gave in to my temptation, and I've been able to get past that. But it was clear to Ramosha that has to be disclosed.
He says, if a family is struggling financially but puts up a good front and people don't know about it, now a boy or a girl are looking to marry into that family and they're assuming that they'll be given assistance based upon the lifestyle that the family lives. Somebody who's called for information, should they disclose it or not?
It's a good question. It's hard to answer on the spot. Chavetz Chaim does mention something to the effect that sometimes you know that both sides are deceiving each other in issues of Nadin. And in a case like that, the Chavetz Chaim says you don't need to say anything because obviously neither side is being fully honest about what they can afford. It's hard to say, you know, whether that's happening over here, but you never know. You know, it could be that, unfortunately, people put up a front on one side and on the other side. I don't know offhand. It'd be hard to know what to say.
Okay, here's a question from Rivka. If a boy is on Ritalin for ADD, would you consider that something that has to be disclosed?
Unfortunately, many people are on medications like Ritalin. ADD is very, very common, but it has to be disclosed. It has to be disclosed because it's something that right now is a condition that they're taking medication for. If the person had been on Ritalin in the past and they're no longer on it, then I don't necessarily know that it has to be. Although, again, on a comfort level, it might be something that they might want to share with each other. I don't think it needs to be disclosed if it was in the past. If they're on it now, they probably, someone has to disclose it. Again, if it affects the functioning, and that's certainly the case with something like this, it should be revealed.
So, in closure, given that there have been so many questions, if you had to lay down like 3 or 4 rules, what would they be?
So again, if you're asked as a third party, you have to first of all recognize who's asking. Is it a stranger? Is it a Rav? Is it somebody who you feel you can trust with information? Then you have to ask yourself, is it a pointed question? Is it a general question? To the extent that it's a very specific question and it's information that you're going to be sharing, which will be kept confidential, I think that it's appropriate to answer honestly. If it's to an appropriate source, if it's about volunteering information that you don't have to necessarily share, the question becomes how serious is it? If it's something which, again, it's a responsible party that's going to have this information, and it's something which clearly is going to affect the day to day. So before the shidduch begins, I don't know that you have to say it because you can let that decision be made after a couple of dates, whether it's something that has to stand in the way of going forward or not. But you have to see to it that it gets disclosed, either you or the parties themselves. I think those are the basic guidelines for a third party. In terms of a shadchan, you have to deal with the question of Eitz HaShen. Again, if a shadchan is in a position of offering advice, I would argue with Neiver, especially if there's a betraying of trust involved, if they're coming to the shadchan expecting a good shidduch, and the shadchan is doing something which is really not in the interest of the parties, and they're aware of issues, you're talking about a serious transgression right then and there of Neiver. And according to many shittas of Neiver, in the classic sense, when you're helping someone do an Aveira, even if they don't do the Aveira, even if you just put the possibility in front of them of their stumbling, if you handed the Nazir the cup of wine, even if he didn't drink it, many hold that that's already Lifnei Iver. So I would carry that over here. If you would offer advice which is misguided and misleading, even if nothing happens, even if they don't even go out, the Shadchan has to recognize the responsibility, or really, you know, any situation where you're coming forward and offering a suggestion and advice which is clearly not for that person's benefit. You're talking a serious aveira b'fnei iver, and that's obviously a big problem.
Okay, I'd like to say... Go ahead and finish, Rabbi Adler.
No, and that's the last issue is the Gnevas Das issue, which is really the issue between the couple themselves and what has to be revealed. And we talked about some of the guidelines, I think, that has to be. Look, I would just summarize everything by saying if a person is unsure about how much to share, when to share, how to share, they need to seek the appropriate guidance of a Rav or someone they trust who has experience with dealing with such matters. People have biases all the time, and how they interpret information is based on those biases. People jump to conclusions, I have to share this, I shouldn't share. People are on both sides, and it may not be the right way to look at it. If you have any doubts, you need to be able to discuss it with people who are more responsible, who have dealt with these types of issues, and hopefully get the right hadracha, the right guidance.
Well, thank you, Rabbi Chanan. That was very sensitively and wisely, and obviously somebody who has a lot of experience. Again, that was Rabbi Elchanan Adler of Yeshivas Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have on the phone with us the well-known Magid Shir from Ergun Shiurei Torah, Harav HaGaon Rabbi Yaakov Zev Smith. Welcome, Rabbi Smith.
Thank you. Thank you for the wonderful opportunity.
So we had a number of questions. We know that you recently wrote a very well-received shtickel in Yeshurun on Lashon Hara. The Chafetz Chaim rules that Lashon Hara L'Tayelis is Mutta. So the question is, why is it called Lashon Hara if it's L'Tayelis?
Okay, that's an excellent question. The Chafetz Chaim says this numerous times, Lashon Hara is never justifiable. In fact, the Chafetz Chaim says if someone is in a question where he has to perhaps forfeit his job, he has to give up his job, he's given an ultimatum. Either you talk Lashon Hara or you're going to have to find a different job. You're not competitive enough. You're not resourceful enough. If you don't start talking Lashon Hara, you'll be fired. The Chafetz Chaim rules that you have to give up your job because there's nothing that justifies Lashon Hara. So why does the Chafetz Chaim himself write in numerous places that what we call Lashon Hara L'Te'elis is Mutta? The answer is that the definition of Lashon Hara is damaging, destructive, harmful talk. Talk that is constructive, that is helpful, is just not Lashon Hara. In fact, if you notice the juxtaposition of the Psukim, when the Torah speaks about Lashon Hara, it says, Leiseilech Rachel Bamecha, and the next word, Leisamait Aldam Reyecha, which means you have to try to help someone prevent a loss. Why did the Torah put these two in the very same pasuk? Because sometimes a person is required to talk. It's a mitzvah to talk. It's a fulfillment of the mitzvah of Leisamayit al Dam Reyecha. Either it's the evil of Lashon Hara, or it's the very important mitzvah of Leisamayit al Dam Reyecha. So really, technically, that's a misnomer. It's not Lashon Hara L'Tay Elis. It's just not Lashon Hara. It's a mitzvah. But I guess an absence of a better word, we can't call it Lashon Toiv, it has become known as Lashon Hara Te'elis. But in fact, the Chafetz Chaim never uses that term, Lashon Hara Te'elis. He just calls it a Te'elis. But truth be told, this has to be understood. Lashon Hara is never justifiable. In a situation that you have to talk, it's a mitzvah to talk, and one should not feel guilty. It's basically a fulfillment of the other half of the pasuk. When we have a question what to say, we're walking a tightrope. On one side, it might be Lashon Hara. On the other side, it might be a mitzvah. But the question was well put, and it's basically Te'elis which justifies it, and it's not Lashon Hara in the first place.
So that leads us to the next question.
Okay.
In Shidduchim, this is very common. Someone's aware that a boy or a girl has been diagnosed with some type of a psychological disorder, such as, let's say, anxiety, but they're responding well, they're going to a psychiatrist, they're getting medication. So should somebody divulge the information when asked about that boy or girl?
Okay, so that question was asked very accurately, asked as opposed to volunteered. The general rule is when someone is asked a question point blank, he's never allowed to lie. You're not allowed to mislead someone. Besides the issa of lying, there's also an issa of lefne'iva, of misleading someone, of giving someone bad advice. If someone is asked point blank, does this girl has any emotional problems, to say no is not true, and it's certainly a violation of the Issa of Lefne'iva and also of Sheker. What must be understood is there are many people that have had bouts of anxiety, of depression. Many people have overcome it, and there is not any trace of it. It does not affect their future lives in any way, and that's something that, of course, should be understood. But if someone asks, did he ever have a history of it, you cannot say no if the answer is yes. What the person should do, and this could be a very important chesed, and say, I know the person, they have overcome it, and there's really nothing to worry about. In other words, to stress the positive, but you can never misguide someone about this or any question when the question is asked directly. If someone asks you, do you know this person, and they don't ask specifically that, that's when the question becomes a little more sticky. Because if, as we said, they overcame it and there is no chance of any further reoccurrence, then indeed you should not say anything. You shouldn't even allude to any problem, because that news, that bit of information is basically irrelevant. However, if, as you, the way your question was worded, they are doing well, but they still need psychiatric treatment, that's enough of a concern that information should in fact be divulged. But again, not to scare the person and say, as you said, they are responding very well, and there's a very good chance that they'll overcome it. But if they are currently grappling with a problem, that's something that people have to know.
Well, let me ask you a question, Rabbi Smith. Let's say it's a type of medication that the person who was asked wouldn't care about. In other words, there are people who are on serious medication for psychological illness, and there are people sometimes they have to take, I'm not sure the name of the pills, but once in a while they have to.
Right.
And the person who was asked says, you know, honestly, if it was my child, I wouldn't care. I understand people have stress in their lives and they have to take pills. Would it be mutter not to say anything in such a case?
That's a good question. I once heard a very wide observation. Someone said that half the world takes antidepressant medicine and the other half should be taking it. Unfortunately, there is a tremendous rise in emotional problems. And if everybody would know, when everybody takes occasionally those little pills, like described it, then I think most people would be unable to find the shidduch. People have stress, and some people take things regularly. That's not what you talk about. You describe the question of a psychiatrist involved with medication.
Right.
But if it's just people that have stress and they take, you know, something to calm them, that's something that you're right. That's not a psychiatric problem. That's part of the, you know, the stuff of life that we all have, and we all, like we said, we're all from the other half that doesn't take it, maybe should, but that's not information that should be conveyed.
So let me ask you a question. Sometimes we have two conflicting halachas, not conflicting, but they have stress with each other. We have lashon hara on one hand.
Right.
On the other hand, you have leisamed al damriecha, don't stand by where your brother's blood may be shed.
Right.
What happens when it's a suffix? You have a questionable situation. So which rule? Do you say suffix deraisa lechumra bimachmer lashon hara? Or do you say Safik Dereis Lechumra and be Machmer on Leisamed al Dam Reecha?
That's, again, a good question. These questions are very well asked. Generally, a person that knows a situation should have more of a feeling if it's more than, you know, in which direction it's leading to. In other words, if it's a 50-50 chance, that's something that has to be really re-examined. But if it's more probable that there is an existing, then we have to realize that it's not a question of lashon hara. Now we're focusing on leisamed adam riecha. That certainly outweighs it. If the question that something in this person's life might affect the shidduch, the potential shidduch, that's really something that has to be considered, and that probably outweighs the possible lashon hara. Because as we explained earlier, when you are talking for constructive, positive, helpful talk, that is not lashon hara. So if, in fact, it's more probable that there is an existing problem, then you should just discard the lashon hara factor and focus on the bimachmer on leisamed adam riecha.
So lashon hara is very much based on kavana, on intent. And I think the Chafetz Chaim says this many times in the Sefer, that if it's not to embarrass, not to hurt,
right?
I think his lashon is Mashes hira tayra b'lashon hara afil al emesim kavanasi levazais ulesmayach lekleinai. If it's to use words as weapons and as swords, but if ultimately the effort is to negate hurt, in that case there is no iser lashon hara. That's right. So which leads us.
Rabbi Yeruchim Levavitz said a brilliant mashal. He said he enjoyed very much drinking coffee. And he went to the doctor, and apparently he must have had high blood pressure. The doctor says, it's not good for you. You have to stop drinking coffee. But don't worry. They just started marketing caffeine-free coffee. So you have the same taste, but you don't have the poison that's really detrimental to your health. And he said, I learned a lesson. Sometimes the thing itself is okay. Just a little bit of the caffeine, that's really life and death. And he says, in everything we do, the kavana is really the caffeine. The kavana is good, it becomes a mitzvah. So the way you said it, if your kavana is to do good, then it's not lashon hara. Exactly.
Well, that was fantastic, Rabbi Smith. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. You too. Have a good night.
Thank you.